WGNS Studio in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Welcome to the Financial Doctor Show, where cookie cutter financial advice just won't cut it. If you're like me and you're tired of one size fits all financial talk radio, you're in the right place. I'm your host, Jason Qualls, certified financial planner. For more on the show, go to financialdoctors.net. There you can send us an email by clicking email the show. You can also find a link to our Facebook page as well. If you have questions or comments today, chime in, 893-1450. Again, 893-1450. And if you miss any part of today's broadcast, you can also catch us online at financialdoctors.net. Just go to listen to the show section. We're going to talk about a controversial topic today. At least we hope to make it a little bit more fun and controversial at the same time. We're going to talk about relationships and your money and how marrying the wrong person can cost you. We have a couple people in the studio with us here today. And let me go ahead and introduce our guest here today. I have Lisa Ishod, one of the top divorce attorneys here in Rutherford County. She mainly handles all aspects of divorce and family law. Hello, Lisa.
Hello.
Thanks for having you. Grant Lichterwalter is here from Middle Tennessee Insurance Group. He is the insurance specialist and also has helped many people with their pre- and post-divorce insurance needs. Welcome, Grant.
Hello. Thank you.
We also have Jessica King, realtor with Exit Realty, and she's also advised many folks with their real estate needs in the divorce arena, pre- and post-divorce. Hello, Jessica.
Hello.
Great for having everybody here. Thanks for tuning in to the Financial Doctor Show. Let me start with the segment we've been continuing on over here with every week here on the Financial Doctors Radio Show, and that is your rip-off alert, where we talk about recent happenings in the financial industry practice or financial services industry, where we find it necessary to disclose information about possible inappropriations by financial advisors. And the one we have today is against Raymond James. Raymond James was earlier this year awarded or had to pay $1.7 million to a Texas man, and he was awarded that much money from the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, otherwise known as FINRA. But basically what had happened to Raymond James, one of their independent financial advisors, had basically been churning the account. He had taking an elderly couple's money and took them out of suitable investments and then bought a bunch of insurance and annuity products. And not only did he buy those insurance and annuity products inside the investment account for this old retired couple, he basically took loans against the insurance contracts, went and bought a bunch of other annuities that paid him high commissions. And then FINRA stepped in and slapped Raymond James with a $1.7 million fine. And the reason they fined Raymond James and not necessarily the advisor, because they felt that Raymond James didn't properly manage this advisor. And this is just some of the stuff that happens out there in the investment world that you don't always hear about. You know, we hear about the Bernie Madoffs and we hear about, you know, the 99%ers and the people protesting Wall Street. But the stuff that happens in your own backyard, like this poor couple in Texas, you just don't hear about this kind of stuff. And we have a presence of folks here in town that, you know, not every advisor is a bad apple, but it's just to always make you think about full disclosure in the financial planning industry and how important is that. So, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to continue these weekly rip-off reports and also to let you know what is going on in the industry and how you need to educate yourself and choose your financial planner wisely. But on to the topic of the day, which is relationships and your money and how choosing the wrong person can cost you a ton of money. And all of my guests today are going to chime in. So we're going to try to make it fun. We're going to try to be helpful and educate those of you. And probably about a little bit of controversy, because it is a controversial topic. When people think about marriage and divorce, it touches some nerves. So that's what we're going to talk about here today. So thanks for tuning in to the Financial Doctor Show. Just in my researching for the show today, Lisa, I came across some stats. You know, everybody hears, you know, 1 in 2 marriages end in divorce. But I heard that Tennessee is a little bit higher than that. Is that true?
Very true.
And is it a Southern thing that I've seen? Is it the South just bad at marriage or what?
I don't know what it is. And when you put the financial aspect to it, one of the big problems, I think, when I get people that come in after 6 months, maybe 2 months of marriage, 1 year of marriage, and they're already done. They've gave it the old college try. They're done. And a lot of it is, they didn't investigate their spouse to begin with. And the big thing, they didn't look at the financial picture. They weren't on page on who were spenders, who were savers, and trying to get that together.
Do people in the South just not handle money well?
One half does, I guess.
Well, that was the thing that I found surprising, which is the divorce rate. Tennessee has one of the highest divorce rates. But let's talk about some of the things here that how making that selection and doing your kind of work on the front end can save you some money. Does anyone here feel like you do have any control? And Lisa, you have a lot of experience in dealing with people that are going through this tough time. You know, I jokingly say, you know, promoting the show, marrying the wrong person. Is that even possible to marry the right person, do you think? Do you think people have some control over this on the front end?
That
is a loaded question.
You know, of course you have control over who you're going to date, who you're going to commit to, and who you ultimately marry. Love gets in the way, and it clouds your judgment sometimes, and sometimes a lot of thought doesn't go to it. In the South, there's a lot of marriages that are religious-based, and, you know, people stay in their same, you know, religious sector, and they don't, I mean, I'm not saying that some religions are financially distraught. not wise, but...
Is there some religion you shouldn't get married in?
No. But I just, from what I see is, with the young marriages and the young people that just can't make it work, they don't think about things. They don't think about insurance, for one thing. They don't think about, you know, oh my gosh, well, she's going to get on my insurance. That means it's going to be a family plan at work. Oh, man, it went from 150 to 500. Well, I didn't budget that, you know, because we just bought a new car, because that's what we do when we get married. We go ahead and jointly buy something.
Everything's joint.
Yeah. And maybe starting out, my advice would be is kind of keep going on the same financial wave you've been on until you both know you're going to be riding it for the long haul. So, you know, those things come up. One spouse gets another spouse in insurance. Then they decide they're going to buy their house. And so they both jump into the real estate market. And that has been a mess. And I guess you know that for firsthand. I know it just because of dealing with it in the divorce side, but it's a mess.
Well, since this is my show, I'm going to give my opinion. I don't know if there's any, you know, we've talked about when we met earlier in the week about looking for cue signs of can you really protect yourself? And I don't know if you can. I think every one of us is probably going to marry the wrong person, you know, at least in something. I think people have very high expectations when it comes to relationships, and they aren't discussing their finances properly on the front end. I think they're going into a pie in the sky kind of outlook on things, and that clouds some judgment. Now, outside of domestic violence and things like that, and physical abuse and substance abuse, I think that people have just set too high of expectations, and one, have very low communication rates. I think that's something that we know we'll talk about more at length here, but some of the red flags that I think people come across, and if you're out there dating, contemplating marriage, I think when we discussed this the other day, is your financial personality, you know, spenders and savers. What do you, is this something that we can address on the front end? I know everybody that's in a relationship, whether you're married or not, you know, there's usually a spender and there's a saver, but even if you identify that, is that a reason enough to call it off or?
No, I think at first they just, like I said, they just live with it. And one person is a saver and the spender continues to spend and they spend by credit. And so the other person will, sometimes they'll hide it and they have no idea about it. Sometimes they'll come into the marriage with $5,000 to $10,000 worth of credit card debt and the spouse has no idea about it. And so in order to make it work, that spouse goes ahead and pays off the credit cards. Well, there you have the first little fire of, my God, that wasn't my $10,000, but I did it. I love you. I did it. I'm going to show you how much I love you. I'm going to do it. And then the second wave comes, and it's another credit card that spouse didn't know about, and another $5,000 to $10,000. Now we're starting to get angry, and this could be 5 years of marriage, 10 years of marriage, and I'm just using $10,000 as a roundabout figure, but, and that's how it happens, and I think it starts in the you're never going to meet a perfect spouse. I think, you know, when you fall in love, you fall in love, but when you fall in love, you identify the love, and you identify each other, and by doing that, you talk to each other, about everything. You talk to them about insurance, you talk to them about how we're going to buy a house, but you talk to them about, okay, what's your credit look like? You know, and don't ask for the credit score before you give your vows or anything, but open your eyes to it.
Why not?
Yeah, you can. It might be a wise thing to do.
I don't know how much weight that would hold anyway. I think what you're kind of alluding to here is just honesty. People being open and honest about where they're at from a financial perspective and then continuing that. And if anybody else has areas they want to chime in, personal experience, but I think that's what it comes down to. I think there's so much pressure today to get married, one, at a certain point in your life, and then there's so much financial pressure. People just hide stuff, and I think one thing leads to another. But that doesn't allude to the fact that some people are just crooked, evil people. You know, like my ripoff report. You know, we're talking about people. I think some people are just incapable of kind of that disclosure. And I don't know. And we're not going to be psychologists here on the air, but to some people, you probably shouldn't marry. And just these red flags. Do you see a lot of financial kind of dominance in relationships and people that you're helping in counseling? Is that, are people working, you know, we got the other big radio talk shows out there that are, you know, that are talking about, you know, I always want to work together. And of course you hear all the, you know, go to counseling and this, that, and the other, but is there more of a prevalence today of people cooperating together, or is it still one person kind of rules the roost and makes all the calls, or what's the situation like?
I guess the people I see, there's always somebody that's going to rule the roost, and that's probably why they're there. The people that can jointly operate, they're able to talk to each other and figure out the problems before they get to my office, I'd say. So there is the control person. You have some, and I mean financially control, some people that don't let their spouse, and it's men or women. I'm not saying the man or the woman does it more, because I've seen both not write a check. The debit card's taken away. That's a control that once the spouse is done with it and the love, this in love kind of bliss kind of goes away, it gets old. And even when they come talk to me, after talking to somebody for an hour, I can figure out why they're there and what the reason is. And their divorce, finances causes some divorces.
Is it not the leading cause?
No, I mean... There's always your adultery, you know, that's around.
Facebook.
Facebook, yeah. I love Facebook. No, it's those relationships, you know, that you want to rekindle and just be friends, then work out. But it is. It's not, I don't know, I guess it's like the snowball effect. And so once you get it, and then they think, okay, well, let's buy a car together, that will make us jointly work together and to do this. Well, one spouse sitting on that page, well, okay, let's do this, I know, let's buy a house. Then they want to buy a house that both their incomes are buying this house, and then boom, the marriage falls apart, because now they got this house, this car, and these credit cards he didn't know about. And it just goes into a mess. And once they're at that point, I don't know what type of counseling would help, because you're already past the point of learning how to manage money, I guess.
Right. And going back to this dominance question of financial, one person kind of being the controller in the financial relationship, I've always wondered, you know, anyone who's been in a relationship kind of has the normal everyday problems that everyone else experiences. But I just wonder how these people... Is it, and anybody else chime in here, how do you not see that kind of stuff coming? You know, if you don't know somebody's control every dollar that you're spending, you know, did you not have that conversation before you got married? You know, is there some kind of switch that gets flipped when you say I do? I don't know. What do you think, Jessica?
I think it actually can change as marriages grow and as different things, and as that whole love cloud fades. And that initial newness and passion is not the same as time goes on and life starts setting in. I think your views are clouded a lot of times.
Blinded by love, is that what you're saying?
Pretty much.
I've got a question for Lisa. Prenups, are more and more people using that to try to help with the financial stuff going into it, even if they necessarily don't have a lot of stuff? Are they?
You know, I would absolutely tell any second marriage and somebody that has kids and somebody that has a successful business and somebody that has assets and a house, definitely do a prenuptial, because it does help a lot. They are held up in the state of Tennessee. It's a valid contract as long as they're executed properly. when you're young and you just get out of college and you're ready, your eyes are wide open and your spouse is in the same position? No, because you're creating what you gain together, and that's going to be a marital asset. A prenup is to protect what you bring into the marriage. And so, yes, and I see, you know, of course, it's kind of funny when I do a divorce and 2 months later I get a call and they want me to do the prenup. I'm like, okay, we're ready to jump back in that frying pan again.
Red flag.
They didn't learn their lesson, apparently.
On the insurance side, we definitely deal with it a lot. We kind of deal with it where you kind of get them after it's fallen apart. We kind of get them through this whole process you've been talking about, the purchasing of this, and we see in the couples that come in together, and even with the insurance that are there to make the decisions and go over everything, we don't see them getting divorced. Where you deal with one person and you never really meet the other spouse, we see a higher percentage of those people where we never meet the other spouse. You know, the one person dealt with everything, the other person didn't care, and that kind of maybe transcends into other things in their marriage. And so the couples that make those type of decisions together, we just don't see them getting divorced as much. So.
Well, I think advice to all the listeners that we're kind of addressing here, you have to communicate people. You have to get out there and find out who this person truly is from a financial standpoint. If it's going to cause clout in your marriage later on, it's worth kind of figuring out now. You know, just don't go through the motions of the, I love you, we're dating, it's so good, it's so passionate, oh, I love you, can't wait to see you. And then don't ask about his credit card balances. Don't ask about, and what are his behaviors before? Because financial behavior, and in financial planning, I address this a lot with my clients, financial behavior determines a lot about someone's success. And at times we have to change someone's behavior. So I think there are all kinds of warning signs in this. And, you know, I think it's worth saying that everyone's probably going to have that money struggle at some point during a relationship. And that's not really what we're talking about here. We're just talking about the bliss out and don't care. I love this person. Who cares if they have a bajillion dollars in credit card debt? I love them anyway, and because that's just not going to happen, people. That's just poor planning on your part. So communicate with your person that you're contemplating marriage. I think that's the number one. Lisa, do you see it a lot? Well, this would be kind of an open question. I don't know how much you would see this, but I thought about this as preparing for the show. Kind of a trial run. People live together before they're married. I don't think they share a lot of expenses. I don't know how much they're sharing bank accounts. Do you see? Would it be advisable for someone to share a bank account before they jump in and start sharing car loans and mortgages? And Lisa, too, you can kind of chime in on this, too. But I just thought maybe you start having a joint account and practice your spending habits before marriage.
I mean, it would be a definite good way to see how your partner spends the money, whether they're, you know, they're conservative or fiscally conservative or not, and they're spending. And it goes into a lot of trust. I see marriages today, they've been married 10 years and they don't have a joint account, you know. It's a way to trust a spouse or soon-to-be spouse and see what their spending's like and see how responsible they are with it.
Right. And one thing that came to me, I just recalled my dating days back when I'm in my early 20s and how frivolous I used to be with money and trying to impress a girl. And I don't ever recall the girl ever saying, hey, can you afford that? They just took it and went on with their business. So I think it's a two-way street here. If you got someone lavishing you with gifts, especially if you're on the verge of marriage, you may want to wonder how they paid for that.
Yeah, that's where those credit cards roll into that.
And then you want to complain about why you have so much debt. Well, it went to the $10,000 Tiffany ring that I bought you for our engagement.
You know, and I see a lot of girls that will come right out of their parents' home into a marriage, and they have never learned, a lot of them, how to fiscally. I mean, some of them don't even have checking accounts, and I think parents, you know, again, the parents teach their kids how to manage money and how to, because then they go into with their spouse, and they're both kind of at a loss and in this puddle, and Visa says, hey, don't worry about it. We got this credit card. Your limit's $5,000. And neither one have been taught.
Right.
We deal with that all the time. People 25, 30 years old, and their parents are still paying their auto insurance. And yeah. I'm like, well, I think that got turned over to me at 18.
16.
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, it amazes us that they don't really, you know, they're just, well, my parents pay it. I'm on my parents' plan. It's like the parents aren't doing them any favors at all.
And I think that makes an awesome point. We've kind of been jokingly talking about communication, but I think it does go back to that. People just aren't smart with their money in general. And you put two people together that make poor financial decisions or have no training in how to use money, it is just fuel on the fire. And I remember, going to school and getting a finance degree and starting my first business. I don't think I even had a checkbook until then. It wasn't until years later that I really grasped how to do that, because it's not something you're taught in middle school. It's not something you're taught in high school. It should be. And I think we're seeing more of that. So two ignorant financial people together are just going to make great business for Lisa here. and great
vulnerable people for the crooks in your business, where they don't know what they're doing with their money. And they think they're giving it to a professional.
And headaches for me and Jess to clean up.
So, that is one thing. Get educated. I think in Tennessee, you're required to go to a counseling session before you get a marriage license. Is that correct?
Yes.
I don't know how in-depth that is. We probably need to write our politicians here to make it a little bit more in-depth and maybe make it a course where we can teach people about budgeting and saving and insurance planning, just the basics of money before they dive in. Because people just don't have the knowledge. I see it all the time, and people that are married or divorced, they were never taught how to correctly manage money, and that's probably the biggest thing.
Or even for those parents out there to sit down with your 8, 9, 10-year-olds and start talking to them about money in the special.
They don't know either.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, apparently. We're going to be doing a show. I'm going to attempt to bring my 4-year-old in here and talk about helping kids learn about money. I'm going to try it. And just some of the things that I've done to teach them about money. So that's key. Parents, if you're out there, you have children, one of the best gifts you can give to them is help them learn how money works. This will help them professionally. It'll help them in their relationships, because everything, unfortunately, in our capitalistic economy revolves around money. But staying on task here, what are your biggest, costs? And we're going to get into the financial planning aspects and what it costs for divorce. Let's just talk about some of the stats here that I came across that, and at least you can kind of debunk some of this stuff, but 1 in 5 women fall into poverty after divorce.
That's probably true.
And that was amazing. And then
that's where I would tell women that they need to get their career and keep their career. No matter what, stay home for a couple of years with the kids, but don't give up your licenses. Don't give up your identity. Don't give up what brings money into your pockets. And I'm not, I guess I hit it from a negative approach, but after almost 20 years of being a domestic attorney and dealing with divorce and seeing these women that become devastated, we just had a recent Supreme Court opinion that basically overruled our court of appeals here in the state of Tennessee, where they awarded alimony in futura, which is a long-term alimony for the woman. And she was making around 70, he was making 130. I think he was an accountant, probably could make more with bonuses. Court of Appeals gave her money forever, and Supreme Court said no. And so they had a 200 plus gross income household. And then she goes into her 65-70. He's at 130 plus bonus. They tried to even it out, but the Supreme Court said no. That she just, she didn't need it. So I think that.
Well, that's strange. We'll hear the opposite.
Yeah, that just came out a couple months ago. So I always tell my clients and anybody I know, keep your profession. Keep up with your licenses. Keep. So that you're not the spouse that's looking there with your hands out at the end, because it's never going to be the same. You've taken joint income or just his income, and you've had one household where y'all could have a lavish or just live, hand to mouth, and then you're splitting it into two. And if the man was the one making the money, well, I haven't yet to see the wife get 50% of his income in a divorce. It just doesn't happen. And so he gets 100%. She might get a portion for a little while. Who knows? Now, there are your cases where it's been a 30-year marriage and she's never worked and, he's a doctor, he's this, he owns this company. Yeah, there's going to be alimony in future on those cases. But the ones that, 10, 15, 20-year marriages, look out. Whoever, and there's the men that stay at home, too, that give up their profession. So I tell everybody, just make sure you know how to make a dollar.
stay-at-home dads. That's kind of an increasing trend I think we're seeing now with the high unemployment rates. But if you need to chime in here with us today, you're listening to the Financial Doctor Show, 893-1450. We're talking about relationships and your money. Again, 893-1450. Questions, comments, please call in. But another statistic that I came across is that you need to increase your income by 30% to keep your lifestyle the same. And the point I want to make here is, I think when people kind of squabble about assets, I know one always kind of, you know, if there's things that have gone wrong in the marriage and there's kind of some bad blood, but when there's children involved, I think it's best to help people. You need to stand back from your situation and put all your personal emotions aside to what has happened and think about the greater good. I've had divorce situations with clients and it kind of all ends up being about money. And we're jokingly talking about money and divorce today. But we need to think about, you know, before we take away a high percentage of someone's income, how is that going to affect their ability to be a great parent? And if we're on the flip side, before we kind of fight tooth and nail to keep all of our income, how's that going to affect their ability to be a parent, whether it be staying in the same home or whatnot? Is mediation something that's done more nowadays than before to save money?
Well, actually, it's the law is any couple in the state of Tennessee, if it's a contested divorce and that's where they have not agreed on anything or, you know, a couple of issues, they have to go to mediation before you can go to trial. So they pass that law. Anybody that's going to go to a trial has to have mediation. And you have Rule 31, that's mediators who are licensed, and I'm a Rule 31 mediator. I think it's the smartest. It's shooting me in the foot, but I'll tell you what, financially, I think it's the smartest thing people can do is try to go to mediation and deal with a neutral party, because if I sit as a mediator, I take my litigator hat off, and I'm no longer representing the man or the husband or the wife. I'm representing these two parties into trying to mediate an agreement that works for everybody. And then what you do is, if it's with kids and you try to work out a plan for the kids, the child support's going to be according to a calculator that's on the internet that anybody could look up. It's a child support guidelines calculator. It's an income shares model, so it takes both parties' income, takes effect the cost of the kids' health insurance, and then the number of days the kids are with the parents. But you sit there, and assets are divided equitably. That's the law, so that means an equal division. And if people can go to mediation, number one, they're not spending big bucks on a contested divorce, because you're going to spend a lot of money for a contested divorce. Number two, you will get out of mediation what you agree to. And that's what we're trying to tell all these people, is that mediation is your decision. But if I go to court and I'm in there advocating for you, and I'm going before a judge that nobody's ever met before, he's going to decide who the kids are going to live with. He's going to decide who's going to get the pots and who's going to get the pans. He's going to decide what you do with your house. He's going to decide everything. And if he ultimately decides what you're going to do with your house, y'all lose, because it's going to be auctioned by a clerk and master up at the courthouse is what happens to it. And we know what's happening with houses today, right, Jessica? It's bad.
Well, let's turn this to the real estate talk. And since real estate is typically someone's biggest asset, and if you have a real estate question regarding divorce, chime in 893-1450, and we'll help you answer that question here on the air. But it is typically someone's largest asset, and it is probably, you know, equity is probably one that's probably argued over a lot. But even if there's equity in the home, it's how do you get the equity out if it is a forced sale, if it's something that you have to sell to do that, that's someone's only asset. What obstacles are you seeing in the marketplace dealing with divorcees?
Cooperation. A lot of times you'll see, especially if you have spouses that are not getting along very well, sometimes you have very cordial, very, very nice divorces, I should say.
How many?
Not very many.
You're just being nice.
I've had a few.
I want to say one thing. If you married a bonehead, then I want you to call into the show and tell us your kind of sad story as well. 893-1450.
But you do see a lot of people that do not want to cooperate a lot. And that's really hard on an agent, too, because you're having to meet with each person separately when you're coming to listing agreements. Then when we actually have a you know, a really good offer on the property. You've got one that says, okay, that's great, let's go. You have another one that wants to fight just to be vindictive. And ultimately, you know, you've got to think of it, this is a financial transaction. You know,
business decision.
It's a business decision, yes. And so, you know, if you're going to be vindictive about it and you're going to fight about it, you're ultimately hurting yourself in the end.
Do you see in these cases that the wife is typically the one that wants the home? And I was just thinking about all the financial pitfalls of divorce. You know, the wife is typically not the breadwinner, you know, stereotypically speaking. Is there certain situations that you would advise, you know, let's say you're working with a husband and a wife to sell their home pre-divorce, post-divorce, whatever, that they're planning to keep the house and before the wife, and she just is, it's questionable whether she can afford it. Is that something that you feel like people need your help on?
You definitely need to sit down with somebody. Probably a financial planner would be your best bet first, honestly, when you're doing that and figuring out, can you afford it? Is it going to work? Because if the answer is no, then you don't have much of a choice.
And one of the things, as I was thinking about this issue, is that you'll be house rich and retirement poor. You'll have everything going into your home to pay your note, and if you don't have money from other sources, then you're just not going to make it. And that's poor financial planning. But the people that are squabbling over these houses, is it normally due to emotional type things, or are they just attached to the home?
A lot of it's kids. You know, my kids are grown up in this house. I want to keep my kids in this house. I don't want any more stress on my kids than what they're going through right now. I don't want them to have to up and not only do they have to deal with their parents separating and living with just one, you know, they've got to live in a different house, possibly change schools because of it. A lot of it is kids related.
And with the real estate thing, this kind of ties into Lisa. Do you see a lot, you know, we have a custody arrangement with children. Are you involved in a lot of cases where people are moving out of the state, out of the city? And how is that, can that be addressed? Because if you're selling your house because of the divorce and you get another job somewhere else, you know, what is some advice there?
Well, you know, the houses are a big problem right now in domestic law and divorce because they're usually upside down right now. And so we're dealing with people that are fighting, and she's dealing with trying to sell these homes. If somebody's trying to relocate and move out of the state, say they're in a divorce, and you do see this sometimes, the mom is going to get custody of the kids because the dad's schedule, whatever it may be, and mom wants to move back home where her family is and where help is, where she can have, you know, third parties assist her. You don't see that a lot of times. They won't throw that out there at first in a contested divorce. It'll come 6 months later on a petition to relocate. Because when you're fighting over custody of the kids, and say if they're already in school and they're stable here and they've been in the same home, and when you're looking at placing kids with a parent, you look at their stability of placement. You know, you look at where they've been, where they have lived, and that's why the fight's over the home. Whoever gets the home, and they've had this home ever since the birth of the kids, and they're, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old, then that's one mark on whoever's side that the judge has to give factors in awarding custody. And so if mom and dad are kind of equal, but mom was just, you know, it's just hard to say stay-at-home parent, and she doesn't say, well, I'm moving and taking these kids out of everything they know and I'm going back to Wisconsin, then the judge is going to do a plan where they're both here in the same county. But to relocate, they've got to show they've got a reason, and one reason is job. To go for a higher paying job, marriage, remarrying somebody, and that's a good valid reason. As long as you're not doing it to be vindictive to the other parent, well, I'll show you, you'll never see your kids.
Right.
And if they say that, you pretty much got them from moving, so they're not going to move. But you don't see a lot of the moving too much in divorce, just because with the laws now on custody, the Court of Appeals just told our judges to try, or actually, not the Court of Appeals, excuse me, the legislature just put a new law down that told our judges that we want you to make a plan that keeps both parents as involved in the kids' lives as you can.
That's
and
awesome.
So it is awesome. I mean, I think 4 days a month, this every other weekend, it is old school. I mean, it's not good for the kids. They, if you got two parents that are active, good parents, and and don't become good parents because of the divorce, but have shown their track record up into the divorce, then they need to be involved in their kids' lives.
Great. If you're just tuning in to the Financial Doctor Show, we're talking about relationships and your money, or the lack thereof. And we have Jessica King from Exit Realty, Lisa Ashad, top divorce attorney in Rutherford County, and Grant Lichtenwalter from Middle Tennessee Insurance Group. But staying on topic with the real estate part here, I have had a close friend that went through divorce, and they had a lot of equity in their home. And one of the things that was kind of done in that situation was, I'm going to stay here until we sell this SOB, for lack, that was kind of their deal. Is that something you're seeing a lot of? You got husband and wife going through the divorce, Jessica, and, they live in the same home, and you're trying to sell this thing, and they're kind of making your life a lot harder.
Not as common as you would think. A lot of times they do move on with whatever their plans are as far as living arrangements goes. And then, or at least one party does. The other party may stay and not have a clue as to where they're going.
Grant, I'll chime in here from a liability issue in this situation. You do see a lot of people staying together during separations or during divorce, and the house may get sold, or you may have already gone through the divorce, and now you have two people living together. What are the liability issues from a homeowner's standpoint, from an insurance perspective?
My situation is kind of different from Lisa, because she's dealing with one party, unless she's acting as a mediator, but I'm dealing typically with both of them, and I have to, be a fiduciary for both of them and look out for both of their interests at the same time while they're trying to maybe not look out for each other and trying to, do some things that might hurt each other. So we have to be very careful, and very good reason to have a good insurance agent is to make sure that you've got somebody out there not only looking out for looking out for both of you, because we've had people call in and say, well, we're going through it. Whenever I was young and first in the business, I'll share their story. Had somebody called in and said, take the other person off. They've told it, proved it through me. I'm doing this for them, and I was kind of young and naive and took them off. A couple of weeks later, the other party called in to swap out a vehicle, and I was caught a little off guard, because the other person, the spouse, had been so nice and cordial, and like there was nothing wrong, no tension or anything, and he flies off the, or oops, the other person, the person that called in flew off the handle, and they were like, what, I don't have any auto insurance. And so we have to be very careful, and now, of course, we put things in place that protect both parties, and that's created other experiences and stories of them trying to get around our stop losses for people being able to do that. But we're very careful in our agency to make sure that we speak to both people and we get everything in writing to make sure that we're protecting not only ourselves but the both parties in the divorce, to make sure that everybody's behaving.
And there's a ton of financial planning obstacles here when dealing with divorce regarding insurance. One is homeowner's insurance. Two is auto insurance. And first topic I want to tackle with Lisa and Grant is life insurance. I've debated this many times with attorneys. And as a financial advisor and helping clients kind of navigate these things, my first divorce decree I read was in 2004, I believe. It was a friend of mine that was getting divorced, and we had done their whole family's financial plan, and their marriage was coming to an end. And I read the divorce decree, and it said each parent should have X amount of life insurance for the benefit of the children, and it spoke nothing about policy ownership. And me and Grant have talked about this, and I realize the issue is debatable, but Grant, where do you stand on policy ownership? Because that, my opinion is, if the benefit is not for the person you're divorcing, it's for the children, and there has to be some issue of control. We're going to talk about that control here.
In my personal experience, Jason, I have no idea if my ex currently has that policy in force. I know that personally I have the policy in force that the judge requested I carry, but I have no way of knowing if that policy is in force, and if something were to happen to her, if there would be any life insurance, benefit for our kids. So there's something that hopefully that they'll address at some point, to have some sort of, like what we've talked about, where you name the exes as owners on the policy, where they would be sent some sort of notification, kind of like a lien holder on automobile insurance, where if that person
at first hand, I think that makes logical sense to me, that if you're going through the divorce and you realize that you do have a need for life insurance there, and the court says, well, you both need to carry $500,000 of life insurance for the benefit of the children, there's nothing there for stopping, you know, your ex-spouse, husband or wife, from just going out and canceling that policy and you not knowing it. So my advice to clients at that time, and I still have this belief, is that the wife should own the husband's policy, and the wife should, and the husband should own the wife's policy.
And the husband paid the premium on the...
Now, the payer issue is a...
Because that's all they want to know. Who's paying
the premium? Now, the payer issue is debatable, because if you have a husband that's maybe in bad health, you don't want the wife getting stuck with a large premium. It is more to say, hey, I can call Prudential Life Insurance and say, is this policy in force? Because I'm the owner of the policy. Because when the person that passes away is dead, you know, they could care less if the, you know, they're not going to know.
No, the person still has to pay for their life insurance.
Yeah, I think the payer,
the name is the other person's named as the owner. That way, it's kind of like in auto insurance or homeowners insurance, the lien holder mortgagee type clause, where if the person cancels their homeowners insurance, the Bank of America or whoever is named, they're sent a letter saying, hey, this person no longer has home insurance, you may want to get some on it.
Right.
Same thing, where if the person cancels their life insurance, because I've been licensed in life insurance since 1998, and the life insurance gets cut off before the cable does. I mean, the life insurance, unfortunately, is very much a luxury purchase, and that's in a healthy relationship. You know, mm-hmm. That's where the guy loves his wife and is trying to take care and provide for his family. You know it's gone. If it comes between the cable and the life insurance, the life insurance is going to be canceled.
Lisa, do you see any issues with this type of ownership? Because I see every divorce decree, MDA, marital dissolution agreement, if I'm speaking the legal terms properly, is that they always just say, go own this much life insurance and don't state who should own it. Is there any...
You know, it doesn't, and it says that every year, at some part of the year, if it's in the marital dissolution agreement, it's obviously backing up alimony, because that's usually where you'll see life insurance in the contract of divorce, the marital dissolution agreement. It says every year on the annual event, you got to show your valid coverage and give it to your spouse. If not, you're in contempt, and that's how that works. You see a lot more of insurance requirements under the parenting plan regarding children and whoever. Both spouses can maintain insurance for the benefit of the children, and some do it to back up their child support obligation. And that's actually put in there. That form was, the parenting plan was actually made by our judge here in town, Judge Ash. And a lot of people, we put in, you got to show it at April 15th of each year, show your tax return and show your life insurance.
Is there any, my fear of that, who's going to police that?
Yeah.
And is there any obstacles by having the husband own the wives and the wife own the husband? Is there any legal thing?
No.
Does that make your job harder?
No.
Because the attorney I spoke with this about 2 weeks ago was adamant that that was just a silly way to do it, and he couldn't tell me why.
There's really no reason why, except that they don't, you know, once you get divorced, you dissolve every connection you have, and you surely don't want somebody owning something you're paying for. And that's the mentality
of
divorce.
With kids, that's not. I mean, if you
it shouldn't
know,
be
for
that
all
way.
Of us that have kids, you're not really getting to,
but
that,
a lot of it's through
break.
Employers. It's not private, but it's their... Yeah. It's their insurance through their employers, and I don't think they can let the spouse own that insurance. I think that's through the group, and you might know more about this than me.
Typically, but. Yeah. But for those that can, they should maybe request that. You know, that it would cut down. It would give a way to police it that doesn't involve the courts. That way, the person could just come to the court or come to you and, mm-hmm. and say, "Hey, this is what's happened. Can we, you know, address this and get this fixed? Because I got a letter stating that the life insurance is no longer in effect."
I mean, that's not a bad idea, but there's no way to police it. The court's not going to sit there and call the person and go through it and see if they're doing it. It's just too much going on. But there is, there you know, if they did cancel it or something like that, or what you see sometimes is them not canceling but naming their new kids as the beneficiary.
And right, which if they were not the owner, they could not change beneficiaries.
Right, and you see that, but, you know, God forbid if the spouse or that person dies, and that you have that contract where, listen, my son's supposed to get this $50,000. Well, Jim Bob gets it because it says that. then the courts will enforce this contract. They'll enforce the parenting plan where he was ordered by court to pay that life insurance, and the second son's not going to get it. The first one will get $50,000. If that's all it was, that's all there was. But you can get it enforced that way too.
We advise also, as far as the using the employer insurance, maybe that should go for other stuff, because we don't really, because employees change, employers change, and if a person could qualify for an individual policy, maybe the courts could require them to have an individual policy with the other person named as owner, if they qualify, if they're insurable, maybe. And then, like I said, then it would self-police itself, even though you're supposed to provide it every April. We know how that goes. Yeah. You get busy, and that never, unless there's child support issues and alimony issues going on, that's not going to really happen.
This is one of those issues. I don't know if there's a black and white answer, and you know, the intro of the show is cookie cutter advice. I think you need this, if you're going through a divorce, you need to make yourself aware that this is a planning obstacle, you know, that life insurance is going to be a small piece of your overall divorce plan and your parenting plan, but you need to address all the issues to make sure you're putting in place the right things that are according to your situation. So getting with someone like Grant and with the legal counsel of Lisa is going to serve you better than just kind of, okay, that sounds good, what do I sign?
Or if you're married to the bonehead, when you're going through mediation, request that, because you can request pretty much anything. Request to be the owner while you're going through mediation, and that way you can maybe get that addressed and get that agreed to while give up something else to get, you know.
Can you be, and I don't know this, can you be co-owners? You know, can you both be named owner?
It's not, no, insurance companies don't like to do that. I guess if you did it before the divorce, they probably, but I think they really, the insurance companies get nervous, because then you've got the whole incentive to, you know, there's more issues there, legal issues. So it's easier just to get the policies separate. And with a lot of co-owner policies, the person, whoever dies first, that the insurance policy stops. And some people might want to keep that policy and change the beneficiary at that time. So we really try to get either policies that can exist once the first named insured dies, or just do separate policies.
Right.
And another thing out there I want to say to the listeners, and if you have to chime in here on the Financial Doctors Radio Show, we're talking about your money and your relationships and divorce. And you need to call us 893-1450 with your questions about money and divorce. And it just hit me on the way of preparing for the show too, is if you have alimony, you touched on this, that's an insurable interest. And where people always say, well, my husband or wife works, we need to go carry X amount of insurance about that, on that, for that purpose, to protect that interest. But if you're relying on someone for alimony, that's, no, if you're dependent on that, now how, you know, we're not going to debate whether you should be or not, but if you're dependent on that income, it's probably a good idea to insure that person's death and disability, because their ability to work is the only way they're going to pay.
Yeah, but you got to look at the whole picture too. I mean, if you've got people that are 60, 65 getting divorced, and they don't have disability insurance, or not say 65, say 50, 55, they're not going to get disability insurance. It's not going to happen. You always back up. Whoever's out there listening and getting alimony, always back alimony up with life insurance. And if you don't, the only way I haven't done it is it's been people that have businesses, and you back it up with this asset or that asset, which is the same thing. You know, if the asset's worth $100,000 and it's not going to depreciate and it's a going concern, you could do it that way. But otherwise, any case that has alimony, you back it with insurance, life insurance.
That's good. I don't think I was aware of that, that they were looking, the attorneys were looking into that as seriously. So that's good news. So if you're in that situation, maybe even if it's a child support thing, do they do the same approach from a child support standpoint?
You know, and that's what I was going to comment on, is that in child support, if you know, you've got all classes that are getting divorced, if they don't have life insurance, and they're, the court's not going to require life insurance. It's not going to make them go buy life insurance. If they've been married 7 years and they've never had it to begin with, it's not an ordered thing. And so in every case, it's not necessarily there. So don't everybody think that life insurance is ordered in cases. There's some people uninsurable. And the court, even though there might be an alimony award, and if the guy has cancer, he's not going to get life insurance. He's not going to be able to back it up. You got to be realistic, and that kind of goes into the mediating. Put on your smart hats, get your chip off your shoulder, and get down and think about this. And the same thing goes with the real estate problem. Well, you bought the house for $200,000, and now it's worth $150,000, and nobody wants it. And I see that a lot. And they owe 170 on it. And it was bought with both incomes. And that goes into your financial planner thing. Don't be house poor. And I've told many of my clients that they're so big on wanting the house. I'll say, if you want the house, you'll have no life, because your whole 75% of your income stream is paying the house payment. Mm. You got to rethink this and think about it. And I tell
them
that.
Lose the emotional attachment.
Get with Jason and get with Jessica and get with me before you go to mediation, basically.
Yeah.
On the real estate, turning back to Jessica King of Exit Realty, and just to throw that out there, a topic we discussed last week about the ability to refinance when your home is underwater. And just want to throw that out there. On the website, financialdoctors.net, go to the link section and you can get more information about if you do have a home that is currently you think that you can't do anything with, you know, contact Jessica. Let her provide the advice, the professional advice of whether you can or cannot sell it. And then she can turn you to me or someone else in the mortgage industry. You may be able to still refinance that house even if you are underwater. The government has come out with some rule changes on their appraisal requirements. I think, as my knowledge is, they've dropped the appraisal requirement. Do you want to speak with that?
They have. I don't remember the exact numbers. I do believe it used to be 5%, and now it's gone to like 25 or 30, as far as the difference in what you owe and the current value.
Right.
A lot of times, you know, if it's a bad situation and it's not really an option, a short sale is a really good option. You know, you've got to have a financial hardship to do a short sale for a bank to work with you on something like that.
Do you have to be buying your payments on a short sale?
No.
Okay.
You just have to have, some type of financial hardship that says, hey, I want to get it taken care of now because 6 months down the road, I'm going to be behind.
Does a bad marriage qualify for that?
Yes. Divorces qualify.
What about the money they forgive? Is that added to your income for income tax purposes?
Depends.
You request, in my opinion, you request not to have that happen.
Yes, it depends.
Request.
There is no law saying whether they can or cannot hold you. I forgot the legal term that when they actually do 1099 you for the amount they forgave. But it's something, if you're going through a short sale, you want to make sure you're asking for the bank to not hold you liable for that forgiveness amount. And from my knowledge, that is something that happens quite a bit.
It does happen.
And but I don't, you know, there may not be as pressing to do that if you're not working with a knowledgeable realtor that understands the short sale process. So working with a professional is key in these situations, especially in divorce. You have to have someone that understands every aspect of this. And you know, I'm grateful for my panel that has been a part of the show today and talking about real estate and insurance planning and the legal issues with family divorce planning and everything that goes along with it. One other issue I want to address here, and I think Lisa can help with, is estate planning through divorce. And one of the things I thought would be difficult is I would assume that, you know, beneficiaries are typically the secondary beneficiaries on a retirement account. Well, even the primary beneficiary on a retirement account is probably the spouse that you're now about to divorce. Who do you make those beneficiaries? Because there's some tax implications to that. If you make a minor the beneficiary, you give up some control for some tax benefits. But if you put create a trust to make the beneficiary of the IRA, the retirement account, you know, that creates some potential tax liability.
Well, if your spouse is no longer going to be your beneficiary, and it wouldn't be, and make sure you do that. There's I've heard of a couple people pass and not take care of their business, and their ex-spouses were the beneficiary of their retirement accounts. But if you name your children, you go ahead and do a will, and you're going to have to do new wills anyway if you've already done that. When you do that will, you do name your estate the beneficiary. Then you take care of the tax and all that through the will. And so in the will, you create a trust that the money would go into if that's your only beneficiary, I guess, is your children or your...
And I think there's some, in working with a legal professional here, you have to structure the trust correctly to make it a conduit trust, because if you do not, then there will be some tax liability for the trust being, taxes will be due. on the IRA.
And it depends on the amount. I mean, you got to look at what kind of money we're talking about,
right,
too, when that's when the tax implications get into effect.
Whatever you're having beneficiary designations on, whether it be insurance or retirement accounts or whatever, you know, when you're going through a divorce, all that stuff's going to change, and you have to address these things. And if you have minor children as beneficiaries, you want to make sure you exhibit some control over that. And working with someone that's knowledgeable in estate planning can help you do that. One, it's going to help you just be good stewards of your children's money after you're gone, but also help you with minimizing some tax liabilities. So that is something that you know, we've talked about real estate and other things here. But I think that is probably an overlooked area
that
I see, because it's at the back of somebody's mind anyway. Nobody wants to think about dying, and they don't even get a will if they're happily married. They
right.
definitely don't go out and
they
do
don't.
The stuff if they're divorced.
That's the last thing they think about. But you're sitting here and you're doing this show, Jason, and you are a certified financial planner. I have had clients that have used in divorce, gone, not only had my services, they've already met with their real estate agent, they've already met with their insurance person, and some do meet with financial planners. And when you get to that, I would suggest anybody that needs to learn how to manage their estate that they're going to be getting, if one spouse was a controlling spouse like we talked about, they need somebody like you to guide them and say, okay, their attorney's already told them, you know, we tell them things, they don't necessarily listen to us. So if somebody else backs it up and says, okay, do you want to be real estate poor, or do you want to think about how you should put all your eggs and where you should put them instead of one basket? But I do think when people have substantial assets and they are getting divorced, and they've never managed them and do not know what to do, a certified financial planner is a very good thing to do.
You got to seek objective advice, people, in all these situations. You got to deal with someone that knows more about the situation than you. But as we close up here, let's recap what we had talked about. One, how to recognize if you've married a bonehead. Do some research, people. Get out there and figure out what type of financial personality that you're marrying or you're married to. Address those issues on the front end. Just don't leave it up to chance, because it keeps you away from the high cost of having to go through some of these issues. And whether it's divorce or not, you know, having high amounts of debt from incurred by a spouse, it can be saved. You can save yourself from that by communicating. So monitor your debt levels, get on a budget, look at your estate plan, work with a real estate professional if you're going through divorce. So divorce is messy. Marriage is messy too, but especially if you don't agree how to handle your money, seek the right advice. Call on Grant Lichtenwalter from Middle Tennessee Insurance Group. His link will be on the website, financialdoctors.net. Lisa Ashad, her link will be there as well. And Jessica King from Exit Realty. But seek the help of a qualified professional. And whether that means financial counseling now, during marriage, after the marriage, whatever it may be, seek the help. And remember, there's more than one way to skin a cat. If we want to educate you, real financial planning is objective. It covers your entire financial life and doesn't always involve products. If you need a second opinion, an objective second opinion, you can call me at 878-2134. Again, 878-2134. Or go to financialdoctors.net. Anything, want to leave anything from our guest as we close out the show here, talking about relationships and your money?
Just to communicate with your spouse, and if that doesn't work out, communicate with the professionals that you know to take care of yourself going through the process.
Jessica, how can they contact you?
You can give me a call at 615-971-1006, or just go online. My website's jessicakingonline.com.
And Grant?
You can call us here in Murfreesboro at 615-898-0053.
And Lisa?
I'm kind of choking here. You can call me at 896-7060.
And remember, the link's on the website at financialdoctors.net. And my number again, 878-2134. Everyone needs to get help in this area. It's going to destroy your marriage. And if you do not get the proper help, it's going to really destroy you. Sorry for the pause there. We've got a little bit of miscommunication in the show here. Are we going to stay on for another hour, I guess is the thing? We can talk as long as we like.
With the four show, of us.
Yeah, let's talk about
Can we get some coffee?
What to do with your husband or your wife when you catch them making money mistakes? The fine line between being a federal indictment or a marital dissolution agreement.